Well, we constantly hear new figures revealing increases in rental prices and statistics showing further shortages in supply. So as we start 2018, we want to take an in-depth look at what's causing this, how it can be addressed and what long-term fundamental changes are required. To discuss, I'm joined in studio today by economist John Fitzgerald, formerly with the ESRI, Simon Brooke, Head of Policy at Clwyd Housing, Carol Tallon, Property District Head and author of the Property Insiders series, and also Derek Byrne, Director of Victoria Homes. You're all very welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
Thank you, Audrey.
Just this week, the government published its report on housing delivery in 2017 under Rebuilding Ireland. And what did we learn? Well, the Housing Minister, Owen Murphy, was unable to provide a definitive figure for how many homes were built last year. But we did hear that there's 17,500 new homes commenced construction in 2017. We'd over 9,500 registrations in larger developments. And in the year to the end of September 2017, planning permissions were also granted for more than 18,000 new homes. John Fitzgerald, I'll start with yourself this morning. Look, there's any amount of figures out there, you know, from different bodies and organisations. We don't have definitive figures, as the Housing Minister Owen Murphy mentioned. Plenty of different barometers, though, that we can use. I know Owen Murphy said that they're doing work to try and get that definitive figure. We don't have it yet. We don't have a single way of calculating every single home built in the country across the social and private sector. But that's really the first thing, isn't it? We need hard facts and figures before we can even begin to address this.
I'm less concerned about the data. I think actually the problems with the data are overemphasised.
Really?
I think the answer is we need to build twice as many or more homes than we're building at present. So I think concentrate on how we crank up the supply of houses.
Okay. What kind of figures are you working off roughly?
Well, I actually published something looking at the data. Mm-hmm. Over time, they used the ESB connections. And there were problems in the recovery period with that number. Yeah. Because there are a lot of houses which were completed, but they hadn't connected up the electricity because nobody wanted to live in them. So that a lot of vacant dwellings, as they became used, were considered to be house builds. That problem, there aren't many vacant homes around that are being occupied today, so that problem has gone down. So I still think that the best available measure is the electricity connections.
But really? Because it's funny, because Owen Murphy, the reason he changed that was the criticism that they'd received for it, because of the fact that, as you mentioned, there were houses that had been built and they were basically just being reconnected.
Well, I think if you can take the 2016-2011 census and consider things over time, it's a but why get caught up? It's an indicator, and no indicator is perfect on what's going on. It is telling us that we are building, we built a few more houses last year than the previous year, but we know from other data based on the census that we need a huge number more homes. And you don't need an economist to tell you we need more homes.
Carol Tallon, if I can bring you in, how concerned are you about the facts and figures?
Well, I would have a slightly different approach, first of all, to John. I do believe the data is important. And what's really frustrating is that all of the data is readily available. You know, we live in an age where actually all of the information is available, should be publicly available. And actually what's happening is that all of these different figures, which are coming from different bodies, whether they're coming from academia or whether they're coming from the Construction Industry Federation or the Housing Department, here's the problem. They're all correct in what they're saying, but they just have a different methodology and their classification of what's a new property or a newly available property. From my own perspective, because my interest is in seeing houses being occupied by, whether it's social housing, first-time buyers, people trading up, tenants for rental properties, my concern is that, or my interest is in seeing properties that are available for use. That, to me, is the golden figure. It doesn't matter to me if the blocks were laid in 2007 or 2017. It's if they, when they become available for people to walk into and to use and to start housing families, they're the figures that are important to me. So actually, I'm glad that Owen Murphy finally came out and said, actually, we don't have a good handle on the figures.
And he did. He just put his hand
he
up
did.
And said, we're
and that's right. And in some way, that quells the debate that's been going on. Because one thing that I definitely do agree with, John, is that we shouldn't be arguing over the figures. They should be a given. We have the data available. We need the Housing Authority and we need particularly the Housing Department to turn around and say, OK, these are the number of new builds. Mm. These are the homes that we have made available. And just to draw that distinction, and then it's no longer an issue. And the Construction Industry Federation know the number of houses that their members are building every year. So they have a credible voice on this. And because there's so many vested interests here, I think that consumers want to know how many new units will be available on the rental market in Dublin or in Carlow or in Sligo or student accommodation? How many new student beds are going in? How many new homes will be available for first-time buyers that can be purchased at the average house price in Ireland.
Can I just bring yourself in, Simon Brooke, as the head of policy at Clwyd Housing? I suppose even from that, those figures that Owen Murphy mentioned earlier this week, when we look back at what was available to the market in 2017, from the social housing side of the market, again, some discrepancy there over what's available or how many people are getting assistance or requiring assistance through HAP, through assistant payment programmes, etc. There's a couple of different discrepancies there too.
Well, I think there's a certain degree of smokes and mirrors in the way that the data is presented. And Owen Murphy, understandably, I suppose, is putting the best gloss he can on the numbers. And he talked about an overall figure of about 25,000 households who are being housed in social housing. Mm. When you actually look at those figures, three quarters of them are living in private rented housing and supported by HAP, the Housing Assistance Payment, which is a subsidy that helps people on low incomes pay rent. So, and technically, they are, the government feel, says that their housing needs are being met. Mm. I don't think that's fair, I think that's right, and I wouldn't categorise someone living in private rented housing supported by HAP as living in social housing.
Because that's it. What I thought was interesting from the figures was that even there's an increase in the number of people that are actually now either whether they're requiring it or receiving it or seeking it, but there's an increase in the number of people actually getting the HAP payment.
Oh yes, and HAP is an improvement over its predecessor rent supplement, because if you get a job and you're claiming HAP, you continue to get that benefit. Mm. So it's an improvement on that. But it is not living in a private rented accommodation where you have limited security tenure, where rents are going to be high and you may be moved out of the cap for HAP. It cannot be comparable to a house provided by an organisation like Clwyd or by a local authority.
I'm going to come to the construction side of it in just a moment, because there's plenty to discuss on this particular issue. Everything from the house prices, the rental prices, shortages in supply, finance, obstacles to building, planning for the future, etc. And we're going to look at them all over the course of the programme today. But just at this very point, it kind of brings me back to, you know, days in NUI Galway sitting in front of economics lecturers, John Fitzgerald, probably similar to yourself, and I remember words like microeconomics and economies of scale. I didn't really know what it meant then, but now I do, and that's really what this is. There's just too many people looking for far too few properties here.
Yeah, we just need to build more. But it's a bit like, think if you wanted to treble or quadruple the amount of butter we produced, assuming the milk was there. To build a factory takes some time, and actually butter's pretty simple. You need a clean place and you stir it. Building houses is much more complicated. So the problem is we began far too late on saying we needed a load more houses. You had programmes like Vincent Brown, people moaning and saying there's no future for Ireland. And they continued to say it long after it was clear there was a future. So we turned around too late and it takes a long time. But really, it is taking far too long, even given the complexity, to crank up house building. And I think that's one of the things you're going to discuss now.
It is. Just, can you put a ballpark figure on it? Because we've plenty of figures out there. I know Mike Allen from Focus Ireland, he was talking about maybe the fact we're building about 25,000 a year. We need to obviously increase on that. Sherry Fitzgerald mentioning figures like we need 40,000 and beyond if we're to meet the projected population and growth figures really for the coming years. What would you put the figure at?
We probably need somewhere between 50,000 and 100,000 more dwellings now. But the problem is, if you build, and this is what we did during the boom time, we cranked up to building 90,000 a year, and then you go from boom to bust. The problem is we need to crank up to probably somewhere in the 30 to 40,000 dwellings a year. And over time, that will deal with the problem. But this problem is going to be here for some time. We can't solve it overnight. But the problem is a shortage of supply, and it's a very big shortage.
Derek Byrne, you're the director of Victoria Homes. I can call you a property developer, can I? Is that, you've no issue?
House builder or property developer, yeah. We're easy, yeah.
You're not in the business of making butter, as John talked about. But from your perspective, you build houses, and I presume you want to build houses. What's stopping you?
Well, I suppose there's a few different factors at the moment. I suppose John is correct, and you know, this problem was 8 years in the making. It's not going to be solved in a year. There's a shortage of labour. There is other factors. Finance would be a main factor. Getting back to the data, maybe, I think, you know, a lot of figures are mentioned, and they're blanket figures. We need 50,000 houses, we need 30,000 houses. But I think the delivery needs to correlate the demand. So if you look at, for example, a snapshot of mortgage approvals in last October, there was 3,000 of first-time buyers and mover-uppers combined. Now, the average mortgage approval between those 3,000 was for €235,000.
235,
which
okay.
is extremely low in terms of what they're capable of buying and what's being delivered. So it's all well and good saying we need to deliver all these houses, but will the delivery match the demand? Mm. We need to just step back, think what needs to be delivered. Because if you're looking at Dublin city centre, there's not many houses out there below 500,000. And there's such a demand there.
But presumably that's because we've so many people looking for them. That's what's driving up the house as well.
Well, obviously there's a shortage of supply, which is driving up. But in terms of, you've all these commencement notices coming in a year's time, will there be a situation where there's a shortage of houses below the 300,000 mark and there's an excess of houses above the 600,000 mark? I think there needs to be a consolidated approach all round of what exactly is needed.
Okay. Just in terms of your own portfolio at the moment, just to give people a little bit of a flavour, if they aren't familiar with yourself and Victoria Homes, you have, I was just looking at some of your own developments over the course of the last couple of days. You have a number of developments on the market, obviously predominantly across the Dublin area, but you deal with residential builds, I suppose, of various different types, really.
Yeah, absolutely. We do anything from your three-bed semi, three-bed terrace house, all the way up to your large five-bed detached in, you know, prime areas. So I suppose we've learned from mistakes of the past, not putting all your eggs in one basket. You need to spread your portfolio across to meet all ends of the market, to meet demand and supply. So, for example, in our North Dublin developments, they'd be mostly three-bed, semi-detached. We would have sold four developments last year to Fingal County, two to Fingal County Council and two to the Housing Agency.
Okay.
There's certainly demand in certain areas for that type of social housing. We're not seeing that on the south side. It's more or less because the price, obviously, there's slightly more expensive prices on the south side. So the social housing demand isn't quite there for the sites we're on specifically.
Okay.
I'm sure they are in other areas. You know?
Look, it's a common trait. Everyone wants to make a profit no matter what they're doing, you know, and we all want to make as much money as we can. But just from a developer's perspective, if you're going out to start laying, you know, bricks and foundations, what do you need? What does a developer need in order to make building a house or a development viable? Like, when you look at the figures in government or whoever asks you to build a house, when does this become viable for you?
To give you a number, it's very hard to build a house, to sell a house below 300,000 currently and make any money.
Okay.
Irrespective of site cost.
300,000.
Yeah, so I could give you, if you pick a house that's 1,200 square foot, which would be your average three-bed semi, that's going to cost you maybe 140 euro a square foot, which would be around the 170 mark. So if you take your VAT off your 300, you take your levies, your water, your finance, probably leaves you about 40,000. That's without paying for the site.
Okay, so about three.
They're real numbers,
and,
you know.
And you're talking about, even you mentioned at the outset there, that 235 being probably the average mortgage that was been given.
Yeah,
out.
That's the facts that are there from.
So is that one of the fundamental barriers here to the.
Absolutely.
That's why we're not building the 30 to 40 odd thousand extra houses that we need.
And I think you'll see builders they're building the bigger houses, which might necessarily be the houses that meet the demand, because that's where there's money and they're hoping that they build them well enough. And at the moment, there obviously is pent up demand, that they will sell those bigger ones because there's a bit more profit in them. It's very difficult to build the starter homes, which is where the majority of the demand is, and make money.
And that's where people are getting, obviously, the first-time buyers grants from. We'll come to that in a moment. I want to come back to a couple of issues on that. If I can just bring you, Carol Tallon, in, just from even from a property advisory perspective, what do you say to that? I mean, we can't look at developers and say to them, we need you to build more houses, but sure, if it's not worth their while under 300,000 euro, why should they bother?
Oh, yeah, I couldn't disagree with that. I mean, we want, for the last decade, I've been writing for property buyers. So I want to see property buyers, whether they're first-time buyers or people trading up or people trading down, or whether they're investors coming back into the market to rent, because we do need a certain element of private rental. So, yeah, we want to see more supply. But I absolutely accept that in the current environment in Dublin, it's not viable for many developers to do that. So, in fact, what needs to happen is that the system that they're working within needs to change. So we've seen the starts of change. There's draft guidelines on apartments that were published at the start of December that were looking at making unit sizes smaller. So essentially what we're trying to do at the moment in Ireland, we tend to cater for two-bed apartments for young professionals or people at the early stages of their career, or even students in some cases, or we go for three-bed semis in the suburbs. And we just didn't seem to understand that people have different needs at different stages of their life. So, for example, we know that divorce rates are up 25% over the last 3 years. And one of the reasons given for that is that middle-class families can now afford to separate, whereas before they couldn't. And that is explaining the increase.
Point, yeah.
So what that means is that we're going to have one household split into two households, but they're not necessarily going to have the budget to maintain two high-value households. So we need smaller units, but they need to be well-designed, that give a sense of community, whether it's communal outdoor space or something. So in Ireland, we haven't provided for the full spectrum of buyers, and that's very clear. And unfortunately, even where developers and designers and private planners are trying to lead the way with this, the state doesn't have the mechanism there to allow them to do it.
Okay.
So we saw that draft guidelines were issued at the start of December to try take, as Owen Murphy called, a more European approach to housing. Mm-hmm. So whether it's co-living or shared space or some element of a more community-based living. And by the way, just to let people know that that's open for public consultation until the 25th of January. So if people have a strong opinion on this, now is the time to get involved. Don't wait for your politician or your public representative to do all the talking here. Actually, we need homeowners and prospective homeowners and tenants to get involved in this conversation. So the public consultation is open at the moment if you go on to the Department of Housing.
John Fitzgerald, just for looking at it as an economist, can you understand why, I suppose, the developers we're talking about the need and we need more supply and we need more houses, etc. But as Derek Byrne from Victoria Homes mentioned there, in many cases it's just not worth their while for the kind of demand that people need.
Well, there are two things I would focus on. One, the cost of land. And Victoria Homes, you've got to pass on. You buy sites and you pass on the cost. And what economics tells you is the fixed factor, that is land, that's where the ultimate profit lands up. The builders compete and they make a profit. But if they're making too much of a profit, somebody will come in and squeeze them, another builder. But it's the land. So I think we need to look at the price of land. And if the price of land continues to go up, the state should be extracting value out of it in terms of taxation and also freeing up land, in that it's, if you take the Lewis to Broome Bridge, you first of all pass a whole series of vacant local authority dwellings which are owned by the local authority on Dominic Street. It seems crazy that they're blocked up and that Dublin Corporation don't make them available, even if on a temporary basis. Then you come to a load of empty land along the way. So land is a big issue. The other thing is, how can we reduce the costs of building? And one thing that people don't talk about, but I visit my daughter in the US a lot, and there you see a house going up, or a block of apart, four-storey block of apartments going up in 3 months. I'm there, they're clearing the site, I'm back 4 months later, and they're built. Timber frame, is that something, and it's a question for you, is that something, it's not something we can ramp up because you have to build factories to build the timber frame, but should that be a way to go and would that reduce the cost to build?
Derek Byrne, if you can just respond to John on that.
Absolutely, John. It's something I've been looking at closely for the last 12 months. If you look at some of the major European, even the Eastern Bloc countries, where they're way ahead at this kind of, I don't like to call them modular homes because I think that's actually a disservice to them. Yeah. They're actually engineered, manufactured homes, which are highly insulated, nearly passive, really long duration. So I think that is something that we need to look at, because I've seen apartment blocks getting built even in London now. They're looking at this model where you can get it built in 4 to 5 months.
Yeah.
So, you know, the situation we're in, I think that's certainly something that has to be looked at.
And foundations are required as well for them, obviously, planning permission, etc. They're a house.
And the fit out and the points which Derek was making about getting, you need plumbers, you need electricians, you just stick up the timber frame, and you've got to fit it out, and that cost is still there.
Yeah, I want to come back to that in a few minutes' time, but just one of the other issues, Derek Byrne, if you don't mind, that John even had mentioned there as well, just from as a barrier to you and other developers building, the cost of land. Tell us a bit about that. How much of an impact is that having?
It's a major factor. Obviously, for a land, like, if you own something, it's up to you if you want to sell it. If you don't want to sell it, it's your prerogative. Tax is probably a disincentive. I know John mentioned tax and he thought it was a way of gaining revenue, but that's probably the major disincentive for a landowner at the minute, because, like, if you sell to a builder, you're paying 33%.
Okay.
Which Irish people seem to have a problem getting their head around, if they're going to have to give up. If I'm giving somebody €1 million, they're going to have to pay 330 grand in tax. So this is probably a cultural thing where they'd rather hang on to it for a little while and see does the market approve maybe and get some more, because we are in a rising market. Mm. It's well documented that prices are going up, so they feel, oh, maybe I'll hang on for another year and maybe get a little bit more money. But I think they need to be incentivised to sell their land, would be my...
Yeah.
And the government incentivised them. But even on top of that, you can look at it from the other side, from our sales point of view. If you're not a... There's two, obviously, major players in the building market now, which are PLCs. But if you're operating in the other end of the market, finance costs are a massive issue. Availability of money.
I was talking to somebody quite recently who's an expert as well in this area, and one of the points they mentioned was that while, you know, for developers, obviously, a lot of, and you mentioned it yourself, a lot of developers are basically starting now again from scratch. They're trying to build their portfolio and business back up. While the house prices have shot up, construction costs actually haven't dropped. Construction costs are still the same as they were 10 years ago. So
they're actually gone higher with the new building regulations, with the amount of, like, you need assigned certifiers now. You need a lot more.
Okay.
So it's actually drove prices up. And probably if you look at the house prices now, we're probably 25% lower than we were in 08, roughly, in Dublin.
Just one other point as well. I was speaking to the Construction Industry Federation, Tom Parlin, actually, just a few months back, and we talked about the idea of perhaps a cut to the VAT rate. I know one of the difficulties the government have in cutting the VAT rate is that if you cut it, it's more difficult to rise it again, you know, and to increase it. John Fitzgerald, you want to...
Lunacy.
Lunacy. Right.
If you give two people going into an auction and say you can have 50,000 more to bid for the house will go for 50,000 more. It won't make it any cheaper for anybody. So given more people to bid for houses, it's madness. Like there's been a series of studies by the Department of Finance, by the ESRI, which says this is a way of throwing away money and making houses more expensive.
Derek Byrne.
I'd probably disagree with John on that one, I think.
I
feel it will bring more builders into the market because those €300,000 houses will then become viable. And then obviously if there's an excess of supply, more supply coming on, that will bring the prices down. The prices will find their own level once the supply is there. Obviously, it would have to be controlled initially. Like in the UK, there's no VAT on sales. Northern Ireland, no VAT on sales. They don't have this mad, dysfunctional, up and down roller coaster property prices, which we seem to fear if that happens. So, you know, I don't see why it couldn't work here. And initially, just to incentivise people to go in, because the 13.5% off the sales price is huge, especially at the lower level, where the demand is.
I think what he mentioned was perhaps maybe a 4% over a 2-year period.
Similar to what they did with hotels, yeah. I think, when they were struggling back in the recession.
I just want to look at the social housing side of things at the moment in the development, because there is no end to the number of figures and publications regarding the number of people that are seeking local authority housing in terms of waiting lists, and also the number of people that are out on our streets looking for emergency accommodation and people who are actually homeless. But just Simon Brooke, as the head of policy at Clwyd Housing, just tell us a little bit about, I suppose, the kind of difficulties you're facing in the role that you do.
Perhaps I could just first comment on an issue that really needs to be addressed,
yeah.
Which is that there is probably some scope for reducing the cost of housing, but it's not great. And the reality is that housing is expensive, and it always will be expensive. And one of the reasons why it's more expensive now than it was in the past is increased regulation. And that's a good thing, because that protects the occupiers, protects their safety, and means the houses are going to last longer. So one of the things we have to acknowledge is, for example, the age of first-time buyers is going up. It's now mid-30s. It was 10 years ago, it was late 20s.
Yeah.
The days when people can leave their parental home and move into their first owner-occupied, those days are gone. So what we have to acknowledge is that the age of first-time buyers is going to keep on going up. In Germany, it's in their 40s, and we're heading that in that direction.
Yeah.
What that means is we need a viable alternative for people who will be purchasing their homes in their late 30s or early 40s. And that means a viable rental sector. And we currently don't have that. So there needs to be major changes, and I'm talking about the people who will be owner-occupiers in the future. So that's one issue.
Yeah, yeah.
The other issue, as NESC, the National Economic and Social Council, estimates that between a third and a quarter of all households can't afford to pay the market rent in rented accommodation, and certainly will have no prospect of buying their own housing. So the housing sector, if it's going to function, has to provide for that group of people. Social housing is part of that for people particularly on low incomes. But there's another group of people whose incomes are too high for social housing, but they can't afford market rent.
Yeah.
And that's a significant group. Nobody knows how many. Nobody's done the research. It needs to be done. But there's a large group there. And there is a proposal that has not yet been satisfactorily dealt with, affordable rental it's called, which is targeting this particular group.
Mm.
And it could be done with very little state subsidy. Owen Murphy has been talking about it, Minister for Housing has been talking about it. There's no actual scheme up and running now. It could be done quickly, and it should be done quickly, because that is a group of households that are currently not catered for and need to be catered for.
Would that have formed part of the housing delivery unit that when Simon Coveney was in the portfolio? Was he looking at that proposal?
It was in Rebuilding Ireland.
Okay.
It was referred to, but they dropped it. I mean, amazingly enough, it was in Rebuilding Ireland in June 2016. They produced a report in December, and they dropped it explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
It's now they're talking about bringing it back again, but there's no clarity on how that scheme will work. But it could be really, really important, because, for example, if we as Clwyd Housing are thinking of purchasing or building a large estate of, say, 100 houses, we don't really want all those 100 houses to be social housing. We need a mix. People talk a lot about tenure mix. What they really mean is income mix. What you want in community is a range of incomes.
And you need integration as well from a community perspective
as
well. You need people of all walks of life.
Yes, that's what that means.
I want to very specifically focus, if you don't mind, Simon Brooke, on one point, and it was something that Derek Byrne mentioned as well. The idea of modular homes, how are they working out?
I agree with Derek. I think calling them modular homes immediately people assume they're actually kits and they're not their pretend houses. All modular homes are is a quicker way of building houses. Another form of modular building is a steel frame rather than the wooden frame. It can be done. But one of the things you have to do is when you're preparing the foundation, you have to drill holes in the foundation for the meccano, if you like, to go in. Mm-hmm. And that has to be done to very, very tight specification, within perhaps a few millimetres. It's perfectly possible to do, but you have to train people to do it and you have to get the equipment to do it. Once you're up and running, you can do it at a great pace.
Okay.
But the point I'm trying to make is bringing in different technology is absolutely the right thing to do, but it's not a quick fix.
Not a quick fix. Can I just bring you in, Derek Byrne, from that perspective, because you're in the business of building homes. Is that something you'd be willing to invest in long-term with your workers, with labourers, to try and upskill them?
Certainly, yeah. I think it's probably in 10 years' time we'd probably be looking at this as more the norm, you know, especially in urban areas. It makes a lot of sense. The difficulty of building around the city, space, construction areas, it's very tricky in high density areas, and especially now with the regulations where people are talking about going higher, it makes a lot of sense. You look at large, even hotel companies like Marriott, they have a modular company now which does most of their bills in modular, you know, so you'd have large hotels throughout the world which are built in this way. Scandinavia, huge amount of modular, Eastern Europe, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, I'd say up to about 80 or 90% of homes are built in this way. So listen, I think it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
If they meet the criteria under our new, obviously, strict building regulations, you have fire, really strict fire regulations, really strict.
But is there a major cost to you in terms of upskilling? When Simon Brooke talked about those very tight specifications that labourers, I suppose, would have to be able to meet, is there a big cost in you trying to upskill people in
I'd
that
say
way?
Initially there'd be a lag, because if you look at the guys who are doing it quite well, they have these huge factories, you know, probably 100 kilometres from major cities or ports, where they're nearly like villages. They're able to build a few hundred or a few thousand units per year, where we would be a few years away from that, I think.
Okay.
So I think initially we'd probably have to, you know, share expertise with other countries, bring these guys in, let's see how
doing.
It's done properly, and then we take it from there. Okay. That'd be my take on it. Yeah.
John Fitzgerald, economist, you mentioned at the very start of this, we just need to build more homes. Is this a kind of I suppose we need a long-term plan, but we also need a little bit of a quick solution as well, a quick fix solution. Would this be an answer to that?
Well, no, we have an expert here in building, and it's not a quick fix solution, but that's not a reason why. Like, we've got to think we're going to need to be building a lot of houses over a long period. So I think we need to prepare for that, but it's not going to solve your problem tomorrow. Builders are the expert on this.
Yeah, and I think culturally Ireland as well, you know, in lots of different things. I know I was at the residential summit recently and we spoke about urbanisation and, you know, we need to get rid of back gardens and front gardens. But culturally as a country, in our head, we still have this vision of our house, your driveway, your front garden, your back garden. Now, realistically, that's probably going to have to change. And in terms of planning, you can see that changing already.
Mm.
So I think, you know, we're going to have to get our head around that. Those houses at the moment, even though there is a huge pent-up demand, aren't selling that quickly, where you don't have a front garden, you don't have a back garden.
I'd somehow want to bring you in, Carol Tallon, just on that point. I think just there's probably a huge generational divide here. And I look at my own kind of generation, because we're the people that are coming in now in our 30s, the people that you'd expect to be kind of buying houses. I don't really foresee a day in the next, you know, maybe 5, 6, 7 years where I will have that stereotypical, you know, 3-bed semi-D in Dublin with a front and back garden. I kind of see me and 10 of my friends in 10 years' time living in some of the other kind of measures that we've talked about today. Do you think people that are out there in the market need to start to change that mind frame?
Now, actually, there's two things. First of all, the answer to the question is yes, definitely. And you're a great case study there. So would you be willing to buy a 2-bed apartment or a 3-bed apartment instead of a 3-bed semi in 5 years' time?
I would, yeah.
Perfect.
Because it would seriously come back to it's the cost.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have the finance to get, you know, I mean, I could probably buy the 3-bed semi in Longford or Carrick and Shannon if I want to commute, but that's not realistic to be here every day, you know.
And actually, what you're saying there is entirely typical of your generation and my generation. And here's what we're seeing. First of all, there's a complete mismatch between the buyer demographic of today. For example, more than one in every five, so more than 20% of buyers buying in Dublin today were not born in Ireland. So they're not bringing this legacy of needing a house or needing a front and back garden. So actually, our outlook has changed. But here's the difficulty. Developers, designers and private planners are trying to promote this new model, this new type of living. But our public planners, our state planners, our guidelines aren't in place to support that yet. So we haven't properly embraced apartment living because they haven't been very well designed. So if you look at the choice of two-bed apartments out there now. They're not great. You know, we haven't provided adequately for shared facilities like your bicycle storage, extra storage. You know, we haven't taken in lifestyle choices at all. Where we've gone for larger unit sizes, which people do want in apartments, they tend to be over duplexes, and not everybody wants that over two levels. So we haven't designed apartments for living. We designed them for students or for young professionals. Mm.
Like, in many cases, it's more financially. It comes back to the finances again. Derek talked about the fact it's not really all that viable for developers to be building houses under 300,000. But you mentioned the different developments you sold to two different, you know, that you had for two different local authorities last year. And there's money in that. And maybe that idea of that kind of rapid build housing, they're popping up in different areas of Dublin. Well, maybe that's more what we need to be looking at.
There's two things there. First of all, in terms of the apartments that you and I might want to buy over the next 3 to 5 years, we need to be building up. That part of the guidelines is that we need to be going for higher density, which means higher buildings, you know, over eight stories, particularly over six stories, but definitely, you know, over eight stories as well. But the second thing is that actually, and I don't like the term modular homes, by the way, because I don't think it accurately portrays what's happening. In fact, what we're talking about here are engineered solutions, alternative forms and methods of building. And it's happening all over the world, so it needs to happen in Ireland. And believe it or not, all these issues are actually interconnected.
Yeah.
Because when we get to a more innovative solution, a more engineered or off-site solution. By the way, look, think about it. You don't build your car in your driveway. You know, all these things are manufactured solutions.
Yeah.
And that's available, by the way. And we talk about expertise in Ireland. It's worth noting that actually one of the UK experts is actually based down in Cork. It's an engineering firm based down in Cork. But almost half of their work is advising in the UK because the Irish system isn't up to date yet. So in fact, what's happening is that we have an innovative industry that's ready to gear up. We have a cultural change in our buyer and renting demographic. What we don't have is the state taking an innovative approach and being quick enough to adapt to change.
Okay, I just want to bring just Derek Byrne in just to respond to some of those points.
I just want to make a point there on that. I suppose, as Simon said earlier on, the average age of the first time buyer is now in its 30s. Now, I think when that happens, what comes into the equation is children, young families, and young families in Ireland have a problem with living in apartments. So I think if the first-time buyer is in their mid-20s, I think the apartments and the urbanisation would work a lot better. But as they get older, people want, with their children, want outdoor space.
Okay, just Simon Brooke from Clwyd Housing Association. Just Dublin City Council, they've accommodated quite a number of people in whatever you want, modular homes, rapid-build homes, whatever title you want to give it this year. That's been a success.
Absolutely. And people were complaining that modular homes were too expensive. They weren't cheaper than normal homes. There was never any issue about price. It was all about producing housing as quickly as possible. Just on apartments, one of the issues about apartments, probably many people wouldn't know this, is 80% of households living in apartments in Ireland rent them. So owner-occupiers are actually only 20% of our apartment. We absolutely have to change the way we view apartment living.
Okay.
It needs to be a massive part of the way we look at our future.
Okay. I want to talk about vacant houses and vacant units and how we're going to bring them back into use, because it was part of the Rebuilding Ireland pillar, I suppose, in many ways, that kind of wasn't really announced. We were due to have a vacant home strategy. Vacant units, John Fitzgerald, what are we going to do with them and how can we get them back into use?
I think it is difficult to define, but we do need to make a change. One of the things I'm concerned about is local authorities like Dublin Corporation have a load of vacant sites, and they're probably detenanted, I think is the phrase used, because they want to redevelop. But until they redevelop, you have the, like in Dominic Street, it's really striking. You have all these bricked up local authority dwellings. It may be that they're concerned that they don't want to let short term. Mm. That if they let people in and they want to be able to move them out, like any other landlord who's developing. Now, I think they're being a bit too precious. They should be prepared to say, we will rent and we will evict you when we need the building. But you could have 2 years of people who are homeless today being housed in that period. And I think the rest of us need to get used to the fact that actually, in terms of redevelopment, that makes sense, that you keep it fully occupied until you want to knock it down and then people move on.
Carol Tallon, would a tax on vacant houses that haven't been used for maybe X number of years, would that try and get them back into use? Would that force people to put their vacant home back into use?
Yes, absolutely, provided that there was an intelligent approach to this. So, for example, if something is going to cost more to bring back into use, then again, we're back to an issue where it's not going to be viable for the homeowner. So similarly for the local authority, it's not going to be viable. But yes, absolutely, there should be a tax where you use it or lose it. It's only appropriate, because what we're seeing at the moment are vacant properties tend to be, and I know there it's a different issue, but they tend to be in cities and in regional towns all over the country. They're units over commercial, yeah, you know, they're apartments over commercial units, that it's not worth the building owner's while to do it, to get it ready. The reality is, and it's not popular to say, we've completely penalised private landlords out of the market. And they were vilified across the media. They were hit with burdensome taxation, poor lending, tax credits withdrawn. And what that's resulted in is a very broken rental market, because now we no longer have investors. I mean, figures from Sherry Fitzgerald, who deal with 15% of buying and selling properties, residential properties in Ireland, they're saying that for every one investor buying, they've two leaving the market. Now, this is a problem.
Yeah. Well, the reality is we actually need more investors in the rental side of it, don't we?
We absolutely do. But look, the difficulty is that politics gets overly involved in housing. And once that happens, tough decisions won't be made. They'll only ever be the popular decisions that are going to be made. So similarly to the VAT decrease that needs to happen in construction, it is politically unpopular to come out and give the construction industry a VAT
reduction. Well, no one wants to be seen to help the developer, I suppose. Is that
absolutely. And in fact, by the way, the real manipulation of that we saw was with the Help to Buy scheme, because the Help to Buy scheme was introduced for first-time buyers as a scheme, whereas actually it doesn't help first-time buyers at all, because it gives them all pretty much equal ammunition to go in and bid. But what it does do, it's a supply level initiative. So it does help developers, because it helps their funders know that if they build the homes, that there's a credit available for people to buy. So it is important. But we need politicians to be ready to make tough decisions.
Okay. If I can just, Simon Brooke, from your own perspective, look into the future. What do you need to try and get more social housing units made available in the next coming years?
Well, just to go back to the Help to Buy scheme, I think if the government were honest about it and saying we need to give a subsidy to builders to sell more housing, and we're going to do that by giving 20 grand to you to help you, then I would have no difficulty with that. The fact of the effect of the Help to Buy scheme simply increases the cost of housing by 20,000 euro for all those first-time buyers that are competing with it. And I think there's a dishonesty in that. In relation to social housing, I think there are a number of huge challenges. The first is that local authorities are going to find it extremely difficult to meet the targets in rebuilding Ireland. If you look at the way from the 1980s, when there was another crash, local authority housing stopped. It took them 16 years to get back to 5,000 a year.
So do we need to change the structure?
We need to reform local government. We need a national body that will build housing on behalf of local authorities. That could be done very quickly. That organisation already exists. It's called NAMA.
There's a piece in the Times as well just earlier this week showing that the plans to tackle the housing crisis by imposing a levy on the vacant sites, of course, that's now in tatters, they say, because there's less than a third of the country's local authorities have actually registered in time. How much of an issue do you see that, Simon Brooke?
In terms of vacant land, the levy, I think that you need to be careful about using it. There is no doubt there is land hoarding. I think that the 3% for the first year is meaningless. It should be trebled, because if they needs to be a real disincentive to people who are genuinely hoarding land to get rid of it. I think the other issue is that not just local authorities that need restructuring, but we need a much bigger understanding of the fact that there are no quick fixes in housing. One of the characteristics of a housing crisis is that, as we discovered today, there are no quick fixes. So what we need to do for once in our lives is to have a 20-25 year plan for housing that will mean that we don't have another situation when we're desperately running around trying to find quick fixes that don't exist. Okay. And what is really interesting is that there is a huge political agreement amongst cross-party support for the main issues in housing. You could actually, I'm not suggesting you'd find a cross-party plan, but if you got a plan from one party that was 20-25 years, that would be supported by its successors.
Okay, if I can just maybe bring you just finally in, Derek Byrne, on a couple of those points, just the idea of a generational shift in terms of the kind of houses people are going to live in, building restrictions in terms of perhaps building upwards as opposed to outwards, and in general home ownership looking towards other European countries. Just how can you fit into Simon Brooke's 20-year plan in terms of how we're going to change how we build?
Yeah, well, I agree with Simon to a certain extent there that it needs to be a long-term plan, you know, and we need to just take a step back, not rush in and make mistakes. Could I make a point on the vacant site levy, which I think is very important? Because to me, I think the councils have realised and the local authorities have realised this is unenforceable. you're taxing somebody there. What they haven't taken into account with this levy is if there's title issues, legal issues with the land.
Okay.
I can name five or six sites there that are on the market in the last couple of months that go best bids and haven't sold. So if you have a guy genuinely trying to sell a site, but there's no builders out there with the money to buy it in Dublin, are you penalising him even though he's genuinely trying to get rid of the land? It's very hard. I think it's a minefield out there. So
okay.
I think that's why you've seen a lack of engagement with the local authorities
on the levy. Yeah. Just in general on the idea on restrictions, whether they be townhouses, two beds, apartments, etc. Obviously, we have height restrictions, particularly in urban areas like Dublin.
Yeah, I think certainly Dublin needs to become a high-rise capital.
Okay. You
know, we need to just get into an age where European capital city, every other capital city in Europe is a high-rise capital. I see it as a feature coming into the city, you know. I just don't think low-rise works. You look at the pressure that's on the infrastructure. All you have to do in the morning is get on the N7 or the N11 and see how much traffic there is because people are buying properties they can afford, which are in suburbs. But I just don't think the infrastructure's there yet to allow that to happen. You know, I saw a statistic there that 230,000 people have an hour or more of travelling to work each day.
That's a huge issue.
And we're the fastest growing population in Europe. So this is something that's not going to get any better.
Okay.
It has to be addressed.
If I can just, John Fitzgerald, just start it with you, so I'll give you the last word for today, just on our long-term plan. What if you had one message today to government representatives or anyone listening, what would you say to them? What really needs to change here in the long term?
Well, I agree on the need for a long-term plan, and quick fixes have actually messed up the private rental market that in a range of areas, and Derek raised the issue of regulation. A lot of the regulations are very sensible, but we need to relook at regulation on height. The Chief Justice has raised the issue of endless appeals. When you have economic regulation, you should be able to appeal against an unwise decision. But to endlessly go through the courts at each stage is not efficient. And so I think we need to look at how we do our business better.
Okay. My thanks to you all for joining us in studio. We may not have the short-term fix today, but hopefully we have some suggestions for a long-term plan. My thanks to our panel, John Fitzgerald, economist formerly with the ESRI, Simon Brooke, the head of policy at Clwyd Housing, Carol Tallon, property district head and author of the Property Insiders series, and also Derek Byrne, director of Victoria Homes. That's it from myself, Andrea Gilligan, with this Sunday morning's Between the Lines programme. My thanks to our production team, Stephen Jordan, Aidan McKelvey and Marianne Kennedy on sound. And I'll be back again next Sunday morning from 8 o'clock. But for me, Andrea Gilligan, have a great day.
Between the Lines on News Talk.